I'd like to start out with two quick questions, and they need to be answered in just one phrase, even one word, the most one sentence, John Anderson. So I'm going to start with you, John. I want to find out what you most appreciate about the accessibility advocates.
They're relentless.
Relentless. So that's something you appreciate in them, because you're also that way yourself. Okay, thank you. That was good. One word. I mean, yay, John. Okay, we'll move to Ed. What do you most appreciate about the New Urbanist? Now, mind you, he has said that he isn't. You are a New Urbanist as well, but pretend just... One sentence.
What interests me about New Urbanism is the commitment to equality, livable environment.
Commitment to equality, livable environment.
And balanced.
Okay. Andreas, what do you most appreciate about the accessibility advocates?
The positing of an ideal.
The positing of an ideal.
Against all evidence.
Against all evidence. So it's their strength in being able to do that. Okay, Brewster, what do you most appreciate about both, since you are not strictly aligned with one or the other?
What I appreciate about both is the planning for the future, working to make things better than they need to be, better than the minimal we could accept, looking for positive solutions, ways to work together that can benefit people in the present and in the future.
Thank you very much. That was good. You guys did it well. Now you have to do that same thing again very quickly with a different question. And this one would be, I'll mix it up a little bit, what would be a win for you in terms of this discussion of accessibility and urbanism and from your perspective? So why don't we start with Ed this time. One sentence, what would be a win?
I'd like to see the New Urbanist movement, commit themselves and embrace the idea of diversity on the ground by embracing the concept of universal access. I want to qualify that. Does not mean every single house, every single front door.
So embracing it as a principle, practicing more of it, but not necessarily all of it all the time everywhere. Did I say that?
I'm talking about it at the community. In other words, providing real choices for everybody in the community. And thinking about how communities age, how people in communities age in place, and how people can remain in their communities for their whole lives once they move.
Okay. So I want you to remember what you're saying, because at the very end we're going to talk about what would indicators be of success. Let's go to, how about Brewster? What would be a win for you in this discussion, either at the end of the panel or in the future for these two issues?
Well, these are two issues I would have to say for us at AARP, both New Urbanism and accessibility are things we really like. So we want to see everybody working together. And what I would say would lead best toward that is for the designers and planners to be keeping in their mind what it would be like to be a wheelchair user, and the accessibility advocates to help people think outside the box and come up with solutions that are the most pleasant and the most effective and the most appealing, and hopefully see partnership and working together.
So the focus is on sort of putting yourself in the other's place. Okay. John, a win.
A win. I have to say,
can you people hear you?
Let me take your an extra.
Do we have a win? A little help on the litter or not?
Did it go off?
Well, no. Better? No. All the way up.
Let's try it now.
This is all actually for dramatic effect. Lauren and my big sisters have been scolding about gravity. I'm working hard on it.
Hold this for a second.
Okay. Okay. I think a win, in my view, would be a recognition that enforcing what's essentially a building code at the federal level through lawsuits, I don't think that works for anybody. And I think that as these issues become more complex and more specific to sites, they need to be sorted out at the right scale. more federal enforcement of this stuff.
Not enforcing this at the federal level. Okay. Andreas, what's a win?
That's fine.
Thank you, Andreas. A little bit more than one sentence, but that's all right. Okay, so what we want to do now is have each person talk very briefly about your interests. Ed has some slides he's going to show, but they're only going to be about 4 to 5 minutes, and each of the rest of you have that same amount of time just to talk about, just expand on what you've been talking about, and if you've already covered it, then just be briefer than 4 to 5 minutes. What would be best, I think, is to start with John and Ed, because we need to lay out some of the groundwork that was already covered on ProArb, just about the regulations, and get everyone on the same page. We do have handouts. Where are they?
No, we didn't do it.
Oh. Okay, Ed has handouts, though. Ed and Bruce Donnelly, and where are those?
Well, I passed them out, and then anybody who didn't get them, they're on the chair right there.
Okay, so we've got some of the basics covered there. So let's get, yes? Great, great. And should we put them, maybe someone will hand them out as well. Thank you, Ed. And can people in the back, do you need for people to speak louder? Raise your hand. You can hear all right, good. Okay, let's, John, why don't you get started and then Ed can fill in any of the pieces that he may think you're missing about. You're the guy that builds it on the ground, and you're dealing with it every day. Give us some background, and then your expand your interests as well, and I'm going to time you guys.
Well, a little show of hands. Design professionals currently carrying errors and omissions insurance. Builders, general contractors carrying general liability. Okay. I bring that up because when we talk about the barriers to building better places, a significant barrier is if you lose your insurance and you can't practice anymore because you're currently being sued by the federal government for violating someone's civil rights. Now, you can get your insurance back later at a higher premium, you know, and if you're vindicated and you actually didn't violate someone's civil rights, you could go and seek redress at the Committee of Restored Reputation and you know, you'd be in good shape again. But the assumption that the delivery of the wrong built form is a violation of someone's civil liberties is the issue I have probably the largest issue with. And I think that my contributions on the list, while rather heated and pointed, come from the fact that I'm in Northern California, where issues of advocacy tend to be more pointed. And I've been reassured by lots of people that there is no broad-based swell of support for the idea of universal access through all doors at all times, except that I keep bumping into people that tell me that this is going to be coming soon and we'll get this worked out. And California tends to be the sort of place where those new initiatives happen. So the idea that even if you establish visibility from a rear door, that's a good half measure, and we'll need to get visibility from the front soon. So I, as a builder, I really would like to be able to have the full range of building types available to me because they appeal across the full market. And while I do support the idea of being able to age in place and stay in the community that you live and build your bonds in, you may not stay in the same building. There should be choices within that. So those close frontage buildings like row houses and those small increments of good development in the small mixed-use building with three or four apartments above are the ones, I think, in greatest jeopardy. Now, the issue of civil rights versus building code is one I've hammered on a lot. And currently in California, the Title 24, our statewide building code amendments, are actually stricter than the technical requirements of the ADA. So you could comply with that, but still end up facing having to defend a lawsuit brought by the Department of Justice. You know, you have to go defend yourself. So I think that the understanding whether building better buildings is something better left to building codes or something for federal civil rights adjudication, I would submit that it's a building code issue, particularly if the technical standards are now finding their way into local building codes. Now, if it's in fact a civil liberties issue, civil rights issue, and the Fair Housing Act starts at units of four and above, I think that to say it's civil rights is, you know, a canard. I think it's foolish. Because if we're really talking about civil rights, what about the rights of the person living in a triplex? What about some poor bastard renting a single-family house? Now, we would not consider the idea of emancipating most of the slaves or giving the vote to three-quarters of women. We would say it's a civil right and everybody gets it. So if it's a civil right, let's not punk out. If it's a civil right, then all buildings need to be accessible under those standards, and any buildings that are not adapted should be torn down, and we should make this happen right now. Cities with the slope more than, you know, 1 in 12, San Francisco, whatever, scrape that nonsense, because it's violating someone's civil right. It's a building code issue, and you want to make better buildings, it's a building code issue, and administer it that way. But the idea that you get to wait and see if someone sues you to know whether or not you're complying with the standard, that's the test, is an unreasonable burden to put on folks who are actually trying to make a living doing the right thing. Now, the folks who violate these issues, they've got to run the gamut on with the building inspector the same as they do for a smoke detector.
So one sentence summary of what you just said.
It's not federal, it's local. Okay. It's not civil rights, it's building code.
Okay, thank you, John. Let's move to Ed. And after we get through this, that's when we are going to have the conversation. Do you want me to get it up for you?
Okay. This has my... The actual name of the university is the University at Buffalo, State University of New York. I think the time has come for new urbanism to embrace the idea of, whoops, we're not getting anything.
Can you switch it to
Okay. I think the time has come for new urbanism to embrace the idea of universal design. Now, when I say universal design, you're going to see that it's not what John Anderson just described. It's something different. The current problems that are reported by inclusive housing advocates, I think, can be summarized in these three statements. There's a lack of accessible single-family homes, both detached and attached. While the Fair Housing Act applies to multifamily, The only laws that apply to single family are the visitability laws that are spreading around the country. The adoption of traditional housing forms perpetuates inaccessibility and does not address today's realities. And third, noncompliance with the fair housing guidelines is prevalent in multifamily housing. From the other side, what I hear is CNU members say that multiple and confusing regulations and variable interpretations of building code officials are a problem, that the zero-step entry required in visitability laws reduces privacy and security in urban housing, and that we heard John say before, accessibility restricts the use of valuable building types, and this includes affordable row houses, small apartment buildings like brownstones. Brownstones were brought up on the pro-herb listserv, and small mixed-use buildings and live-work units. Now, I think there is common ground between the advocates of accessibility and universal design and the new urbanist movement, but I think we'll have to get into that later, what the common ground is. What does universal design have to say about new urbanism, or what's the relationship? Universal design would advocate communities that are safer, enable active living, and foster participation for all. It's not just code compliance. It goes way beyond code compliance because the codes are basically a bottom line minimum requirements that prevent discrimination. That's what they're about. And basically, universal design in the new urbanist context would extend the benefits of urbanism to a broader range of people. The driver of universal design is new demographics. Just a few pieces of data. The population over 65 is going to double by the year 2030 to 20% of the population. I saw slides yesterday that indicate that in traditional neighborhood development, the percentage of people over 50 is much higher than I was expecting. The incidence of disability is rising rapidly. It's not going away because of medical technology, because the population is aging. 85 to 90% of people over 50 want to age in place, stay in the communities they're in. 80% of all 50-plus home buyers want one-story homes, prefer one-story homes. The trend is towards residential-based health care, and that will mean more demand for accessibility in the home. The key to long life, the recent research finds, is mental and physical activity. And very recently, some new research shows that very small improvements in housing accessibility have a positive impact on mortality, not just on feeling good, but on mortality in old age. So what is the challenge? How do we get accessibility to affordable townhouses? Will it ruin the type as an urban building type? Will it ruin its quality and its availability? And how do we get accessibility to small apartment buildings like brownstones? Well, I'd like everybody to know that there are urban precedents. I was at Federal Hill in Baltimore, and I saw many houses that were right down on grade. And if you notice, they don't have their curtains drawn or shutters. On the right, on the left, they don't. They don't all have. We can talk about what privacy is in a little while. I teach the whole notion of privacy and territoriality. And notice that there are plantings and ways to keep people away from the front of the building. This is a affordable housing project in South Earswick, UK. I encourage you all to go there if you're ever in the area. It's in York. And this is developed by the Roundtree Housing Trust. And they're pioneers with the idea of lifetime housing. And this is an application to affordable townhouse developments. And notice they use front yards and plantings and gates and fences to provide privacy and security. And this, excuse me? Okay, this is an affordable housing project in Pittsburgh, a Hope 6 project. Again, different ways to provide security and privacy. And this is Jakriborg, a new urbanist community, Danish Gothic, in southern Sweden. I visited this community, saw very few shuttered windows, curtains, very exciting and interesting place, and very popular. And this is an interesting adaptation of townhouses on Beacon Hill, which suggests a lot of ideas for new urbanists to incorporate in where streets are sloping. And this is housing on a floodplain, accessible with raised access walk. That's my last slide. This is Abacoa. And wherever I've been to about 7 new urbanist communities, and I find that there are a lot of missed opportunities. Stairs in the front, but only one step up in the back. This could easily have had a one-step entry from the garage or from the terrace. And I just want to conclude with the handout that was sent out is a proposal, Bruce Donnelly's idea and one that I fully embrace, to develop a pattern book or some sort of document that would help new urbanists find ways to increase accessibility and identify where it's not possible, where are the wicked cases and what could be done about those, if anything. And this is just this is the first project that we've looked at in my center. We've done three different building types. This is looking at the brown house concept in today's context. And I have some others. I have two more with me that I can show you later after the session.
Okay. Thank you, Ed. Thank you very much, Ed. Yeah, come back to this. Did you want to refer to a picture up here? Or? Huh? Okay. I was going to go to Brewster next, but...
just a few things. First of all, I think we need to clarify where the confusion comes from. And I am confused. There's intrinsic and extrinsic confusion. Okay, the intrinsic confusion is that I just received the manual for accessibility for Dade County, and it is thicker than virtually any other code I own. It's such a nightmare in interpretation and so forth that I actually need a new consultant. There's a new kind of consultant now that I call to explain it to me. Okay, so there is no law that should be that complex. So there's a problem there, like the fear of tripping up, like what am I doing? Am I doing something wrong? So I think we need to simplify whatever codes there are. That's one problem. The other problem is that there seem to be three layers of law or not law, and it's not clear. There's ADA, whatever that is. There is visitability, which I do understand, thanks to Eleanor, perfectly. And there is the Fair Housing Act, whatever that is. And I'm confused. And some are law, and some are not. Okay? But when, for all intents and purposes, there are things happening now that, and by the way, when they're law, I respect anything that has been discussed in public that's a law that is to be respected. What I don't like are people writing standards and then administering them by lawsuits. Because even if the lawsuit is won or lost, it is still a fundamental problem. Now, as it happens, very conveniently, we've been sued for the first time in my life after 35 years of practice, and it was this way. We did one project for Post Communities, Post Columbus. Post Columbus owns probably 45,000 apartments in this country built since 1970. They were categorically sued for all of them. And we did one some 10 years ago, and we are as fully sued as anybody else. And as far as I can tell, we've complied with all the laws. I believe we complied with all the laws. I'm certain we did. But we still get dragged into a lawsuit that is simply terror. It's being administered by terror. Okay? People are now terrorized. It doesn't matter after this lawsuit of Post Properties, which I believe is the largest apartment developer in this country. It doesn't matter whether it's law or not. For all intents and purposes, we have to follow the rules. Okay? That is not a democracy. Okay, that is a completely Stalinist operation, American style. Okay, so that's, thank God that happened before this Congress instead of after, because I wouldn't be able to tell you the story. Now, to get on with it, I wish somebody would clarify what it is, but here's the things. Okay, accessibility. I actually love the visibility, and they're in the smart code. Okay, they're in the smart code, as I promised Eleanor. But the visibility that I see is actually accessed by any door. The inside is fine. You know, the bathrooms, the hallways, that's fine. That's just a better standard. It's a better unit. But to enter from the back in certain units is, in fact, not only permits virtually every building type to actually be restored to use, but that's where most people enter anyway in new urbanist communities, you know, which is where you park, okay? So I think entrance by any, from any side, and some of the ones that you showed are from the side, et cetera. The problem is with the short setbacks that are so important to urbanism, having the entrance to the front. Okay. The second thing I would like to propose is that there be some concept of help. Like my house is three steps up, and we installed little ramps everywhere, little sharp ramps. And my grandmother maneuvered them, and as she got very, very old, to be 99, she was maneuvered them with a little help. And I think the concept of help, you know, rather than absolute freedom to do everything, is something that needs to be folded in. And here's an analogy. Actually, half of America, or the America that is being built, is not accessible to half the population. Every time you build an automobile-oriented place, which is the entirety of the suburbs, half the population can't get to it, right? They just can't get to it. They can't get to the McDonald's. It doesn't matter if the McDonald's has a ramp, you can't get there in the first place. For half the population, the old, the young, and the poor who don't drive. And then people say, well, why can't they get a ride? Right? Why can't they get a ride? Why can't they do a little minor administrative and arrange to get a drive? And I always say, well, why can't people who have difficulty moving around get a little help? Okay? Which is what my mother, or grandmother, got all her life. It wasn't difficult. Now, one thing, wait, because I want to. What would be an incredible breakthrough is this. By the way, I have no respect for time. Pay attention to reality. The Zen is the reality of what's being said, not that English invention from Greenwich, which is called time. That is abstract. Okay, the Zen of our culture is what I'm saying. Okay, now let me just finish because this is important. Because I have to, the ramp, the shortness of the ramp, the deadly thing is the constant 1 in 12 ramp. The 1 in 12 ramp. If you go up 3 steps, okay, the ramp has to be a minimum of 18 feet long. 18 feet. That is untenable, you know, in most traditional urbanism. There's a little, and I understand that ramps need to be 1 in 12 when they're long, because muscle power needs to be used to go up. But for example, if you only go up 6 inches, and the ramp could be 1 in 4, that would only be 4 feet. That would only be 2 feet. If there could be a gradation of ramps that could be empirically decided, that could be done by muscle power, we could actually have a totally creative solution. And you know the problem we're going to confront, the ADA problem right now, is that the nexus, the tragedy of what's happening in New Orleans, in which FEMA requires the units to be all of New Orleans houses, all the single family houses in New Orleans are in small lots. They have to be 3 feet up for FEMA, and the ramp doesn't fit. Okay, so the houses cannot meet livability or anything else, and they may not be rebuilt for this alone. And by the way, when I confront the people writing the standards of this, you know, people in wheelchairs, et cetera, come in violent like this, and I say, this is the problem, they go silent. There is no help. It's the silent treatment. There is no counter proposal.
Okay, so hopefully we won't have the silent treatment here, because where we can really move forward, Andreas, is trying to figure out some things in conversation here with other people.
But they're not conversing.
But they
there's no conversation.
You're not giving us a
You're
chance.
Not You're
Brewster, let's give you your 5 minutes.
This.
Can everyone hear him in the back? Okay, hold that a little bit closer,
yeah,
Brewster.
Sorry about that. What I'm saying is there's 2.2 million people, half of 1% of the U.S. population, use wheelchairs on a daily basis. Many more use scooters and walkers and other mobility aids. But what it comes down to is we are talking about a small percentage of the population. However, what I've very much learned is when it comes to the question of civil rights, keeping is asking them what is and isn't it.
Thank you, Brewster. We're right on time. Okay, so now comes the part. I think what I heard from you most is, like, let's not miss the opportunities where we could do these things and not harm urbanism, not cost more, but at least know what those are. Okay, so now let's talk about, is there any common ground? And I want you to talk to each other and look at each other.
But these are not representative.
Try it, Andreas.
No, we're all in agreement.
Ed, go ahead.
I actually had a slide about our common ground, and I agree with Andreas. I think we're in agreement mostly, but I think there might be some areas of misunderstanding.
Ed, you want to put your microphone a little bit closer? I'm sorry to keep saying that. It's hard to hear in the back. Well, let's actually talk about then a model like Kentland's, where some things are not addressed from accessibility. And John and Andreas, jump in on this so we can actually dig out the differences.
Okay, so, but to that point, to that point, are the folks who would not demand it going to show up if that starts to become more common? Say, at some bellwether place like Berkeley, where they would need to be lining up with lower life forms like builders and developers to say, no, no, please, you know, visibility from the rear is fine. My friends who are more zealous in their advocacy should just back the hell up and not push this issue. I would suspect that when it comes down to, you know, siding for visibility over full accessibility, that we're not going to see our friends from that advocacy show up.
John and I do have a particular perspective on this, being Californians, and it's just because
we've been hurt before. Yeah.
We know the signs. We just know them. And there, we do know that that's where it's headed in California, and where California goes, often these go. So that's why there is that real sensitivity, like, oh, no, we just a little bit more. Well, we know it's actually just part of a larger picture.
Yep.
With California advocates.
Now, we're very, very happy to be wrong on this score. You know, I don't need to be right about this at all. But actually, to one of the slides that Ed showed, the project in, I was at Norway, with the little cobbles in the front. In Sweden.
So talk to Ed.
Talk to Ed. So Ed, I think that, how are you? The well, it's been my experience, and a show of hands, I think bald guys are typically always in the right. That example of the townhouses on the little minor street with the cobbles to the side, as a building type, that works on a little mews, a little remote situation. But we really depend on the row house as this, the building block of an everyday good street that would be much busier. A row house, you know, a brownstone or a row house in a downtown setting is a good transition, you know, as a good T4 building. We really need that building to be kind of robust and brought close to the street and the like. I think an attached at-grade row house works very well in more of a courtyard or where that when the street is very much a common pedestrian space with the occasional car and not something carrying, say, 10,000 cars a day. And we need that building type to be very flexible so it can do lots of different things. So an accessibility from the rear, I think, is for visibility is a very reasonable thing. And I think that if new urbanists go and build lots of that stuff, they'll have a tremendous competitive advantage over folks who can't quite figure out how to do that, just as they can't quite figure out how to get the garage up in front of the house.
Ed, can you understand the perspective, and jump in, Andreas, if you have something to say, too, that it sounds like we can all be together and visibility's in the smart code and there needs to be some visitable, some not, or some accessible, some not, the row house, et cetera. All visitable, but not necessarily from the front door. So Ed, address that.
I understand what John is saying, and I think that the houses that I showed at Yachtreport are perfectly fine for that location. But if you had a busy street out front, certainly wouldn't want to, as an architect, I wouldn't design it. By the way, I'm a licensed architect, and I do design houses. And I certainly wouldn't do it. There are other options for row houses. For example,
Andreas, go ahead.
But a busy street, that might work
okay.
Well. Another, let me just throw another one out. We have a prototype design for taking the brownstone concept. Now, brownstone has, in many cases, a full height of stairs, full story of stairs up to the main floor. Remember, those houses were single family houses. So if you have a one story unit on the first floor with direct
Well, and you see that in raised basement houses in Savannah, but you say take the English basement, where the street level is brought up, the area is in the front, and then the access is off the natural grade in the garden. I think that works fine. But the
hold the microphone up a little bit.
Oh, but the issue of the tougher ADA compliance in things like LiveWorks, we've done them where. You have to be able to come in from the front. You have to have that bathroom on the ground floor. And if you've established a unit above, well, IKEA has all that cool stuff you could put in there. So, but the and then if you have a unit above, we typically code separate those, and it's just a walk up for a one unit, which gets you outside of fair housing. So there are a lot of solutions to be done with design once the parameters are there.